The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author of Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests. A reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer for more than three decades, Jennifer Lin worked as an international correspondent in China, a national correspondent in Washington, D.C., and a financial correspondent on Wall Street. She is also the author of the well-reviewed family memoir, Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family. Lin's documentary, Beethoven in Beijing, co-directed with Sharon Mulally, was originally released to coincide with the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth and later premiered on PBS's Great Performances. In her beautiful new companion book, just published by Temple University Press, Lin uses diary entries and interviews with diplomats, journalists, and musicians, along with news stories, to recount the Philadelphia Orchestra's 1973 historic tour of China, which at that time still banned Western music. Tonight, Jennifer will be in conversation with Nydia Han, consumer investigative reporter and co-anchor of 6ABC Action News Sunday Mornings, and the winner of an Emmy Award and the 2019 Pearl S. Buck Woman of Influence. She's also the creator of the documentary series, Hashtag This Is America. Please join me in welcoming Jennifer Lin and Nydia Han to the Free Library.
This is so exciting, an in-person event. This is one of my first since the pandemic began, and it is so wonderful to see all of you here. Thank you for coming. Jennifer, it is such an honor to be talking to you tonight.
Thank you, Nydia, and thank you for being here.
The last time I had the pleasure of interviewing you, we were talking about your film, Beethoven in Beijing. What a delight to now be talking about your book, Beethoven in Beijing.
Yes.
First, just broadly for context, I mean, this Beethoven in Beijing project has everything: international politics, mystery, and of course, music. So let's give people, just for context, what is this all about?
Sure. So Beethoven in Beijing tells the story of the Philadelphia Orchestra's China legacy. And this has been something I've been researching for about 6 years now. The orchestra has this unique place in history because they were the first American orchestra to perform in the People's Republic. And it came on the heels of Nixon's groundbreaking trip to China. So after Nixon went to China in 1972, he wanted there to be a cultural relationship between China and the United States. So he asked his favorite conductor, Ormandy, to go to China with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So I've always felt that this would be a great subject for a documentary. So I pitched the orchestra in November of 2015, and Catherine Blodgett is here tonight. She was PR for the orchestra at the time, and I said, Catherine, this is like a natural documentary. Would you guys, you know, be interested? And so it started there. The orchestra, you know, we had many conversations, and they asked me, you know, this is your first documentary, because I left the Inquirer in 2015. And they said, have you ever made a documentary? I said, no. They said, well, how would you do it? I said, I would learn. And they said, well, how would you fund it? I said, I don't know. They said, okay, we'd like to introduce you to a guy named Sam Katz, who makes documentaries in Philadelphia. And everyone who was a reporter at the Inquirer knew who Sam Katz was. He's a very prominent person in the city. So I pitched it to Sam, who's here tonight, and I said, Sam, you know, would you be interested? And he was. So long story short, you know, we started filming in 2016. Sharon Mulally, my co-director, is here tonight. And we made three trips to China with the orchestra. I made one other trip with the Curtis Institute. And it premiered on PBS's Great Performances a year ago, actually almost a year ago this week. So that's the story of the documentary. It was a long march, a long journey. But, you know, that was the genesis of this.
It is a wonderful film if you have not yet seen it. And it is for all ages. I watched it with our daughter who's here tonight. She'll be 10 at the end of the month. And as soon as it was over, she said, can we watch that again? She just loved it. And now I know that she's excited to also read the book. So speaking of the book, why did you decide to write it?
Because I had more to say. So as I mentioned, I had been researching this topic for a long time, you know, really beginning in 2015 by going to the archives at Penn, the Ormandy archives, by going to Temple, the Urban archives, and by interviewing musicians and members of the Philadelphia Orchestra. I must have interviewed, you know, at least 50, 75. I lost track. But, you know, when you make a film, as I learned, you really have to distill everything. And there was so much material that wasn't used in the film. So I had an abundance of material, and I felt there was just more to say, frankly. And the other thing that motivated me to write a book was the pandemic, because we, Sharon and I, locked the film on March the 1st, 2020, just as the world was ending. And we had planned on going to all these film festivals across the country. We got into like 15 festivals, and that was the plan for 2020. But then all of a sudden, we're all in our attics. And so, you know, my husband was on his side of the attic doing his work, and my daughter, who came for a four-day visit and stayed for 4 months, she was down, you know, in the living room doing her work. So I needed something to do, and I thought, you know, I always felt that this warranted a book. So I started writing the book and pitched it to Temple University, and here we are today.
Those of you who know Jennifer Lynn know that this story is so Jennifer Lynn. So instead of taking the time to take a break or rest, she decides to write an entire book during the pandemic. I love that about you.
Yeah.
I love the format of the book. It's an oral history, meaning Jennifer has taken pieces of interviews and material and journals and eyewitness accounts and woven all of these things together to tell this remarkable story. So you really feel like you are an eyewitness. You're right there as this story unfolds and this history unfolds. Why did you decide on that format?
I think you have to understand where China and the United States were in 1973. We did not have diplomatic relations. Although Nixon went there, there wasn't the sort of travel that we see today. There weren't people living in China, Americans. In fact, it's estimated that at the time that the orchestra went to China, there were fewer than 100 Americans living in China. Then all of a sudden, 130 Philadelphians show up in Beijing and Shanghai, and they're, you know, they're walking around the city, they're performing, and it was historic and memorable both for the Philadelphia musicians and for the Chinese people they encountered. And I thought, you know, let them tell their story. Let's put it in their voice and I'll get out of the way. So, you know, I decided to tell it as oral history, and, you know, I'll let you in on a little secret. It was a lot easier than writing a book. It was more like a puzzle where you're trying to take all these quotes and put it into a coherent story, so more like a puzzle with like 5,000 pieces than a book. So it was actually a lot of fun to write, and I don't view writing as necessarily a fun activity. It's work, and it's something I do work at. But this was different, and so it all kind of came together, and it all started making sense.
I'd like to get to some of the stories in just a moment, but first, a little inside journalism baseball. I mean, one of my favorite things that you told me is that one of the sources for the book was WikiLeaks. What did you find on WikiLeaks?
So I'm there in my attic and, going down the Google rabbit hole. And so, you know, I would periodically Google Philadelphia Orchestra China 1973, and up popped this link to unclassified cable in WikiLeaks. So Julian Assange, thank you very much. He has posted on WikiLeaks, you know, all unclassified cables that he could get. And if you just put in the search element, Philadelphia Orchestra in China, bam, up popped every unclassified cable between the American diplomats who were in China in 1973 and their counterparts at the State Department. Now, we didn't have an embassy, but we had an office. And so in the months prior to the orchestra going to China, there were all these back and forth cables that some of them were hysterical because the Chinese couldn't settle on, a program. They were not telling the orchestra, what Ormandy should play and when. They didn't even know how many concerts they were going to have. And there was like one cable, I think it was like in late August of 1973. Now the trip was in September of 1973. So I think it was Nick Platt, who was the diplomat in Beijing at the time. He's cabling his counterpart saying, or no, vice versa, sorry. It was the person at the State Department cabling Nick Platt in Beijing saying, Ormandy would like to know what the program is before he steps onto stage. So could you nudge the Chinese to kind of make some decisions here? So WikiLeaks was just one of the new sources of material that I was able to include in the book. And there were some great things because, again, you have to remember where China and the United States were. Nixon had started to warm things over, but we still didn't know where China was going. Now, 1973 is still the Cultural Revolution. 1966 was when it began, and that's when it was at its worst. It had calmed down by 1973, but it was still the Cultural Revolution. And so the American China watchers, they didn't know where China was going. Like, Zhou Enlai had made these overtures to Nixon. Nixon met Mao. That was all good. But were they really warming up to the United States, or would this just be a phase? So they used the visit of the Philadelphia Orchestra really to read the tea leaves, to try to gauge, like, what the relationship was. And I remember there was this one cable that Nick Platt in Beijing wrote to his counterpart in Washington after the wife of Chairman Mao, Jiang Qing, showed up at one of their concerts. And Nick goes into excruciating detail on what she wore and what her watch looked like. And she carried a handbag, and she wasn't wearing a Mao suit. And they saw that as, like, very important, So he's writing back to the Home Office, describing all this. So anyway, it was just, it was really fun to read those cables.
Before, during, and after the tour, every single gesture, every word, every article of clothing was analyzed and negotiated so carefully. Mm-hmm. I think that you say in your book that usually the orchestra knows a year in advance what they'll be performing, but there were changes to the program even after they arrived in China, right?
Right, exactly. So if you've seen the movie, which you can view on PBS's platform called Passport, they showed up in Beijing, and Ormandy had the music for Beethoven's Fifth, which they did perform in Shanghai, but he was going to perform it at this big concert for the leaders. And then he heard from Nick Platt and others that the Chinese would not like the Fifth when Madame Mao's in the audience. They'd rather hear Beethoven's Sixth. And Ormandy's like, well, I didn't bring the music for the Sixth, so we're going to play the Fifth. And then it was like, you don't understand. So ultimately, Ormandy capitulated and they did play the Six. But that was a bit of diplomatic work that Nick Platt had to do to convince Ormandy, who was a bit of a diva, to change his plans. They ended up sending, the Chinese hosts sent military planes to Shanghai to pick up some scores. And they also got scores from the Central Philharmonic, which is based in Beijing. So it's a funny anecdote because a lot of the scores were handwritten and full of mistakes and wrong notes. But, as one of our characters in the movie says, this is the Philadelphia Orchestra you're talking about. This is Beethoven. They could basically do it in their sleep.
Right. Take us into the minds of some of the musicians and Ormandy. I imagine there was some measure of trepidation because this was, as you say, at the time of the Cultural Revolution. Music had been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Musicians had been killed. There was so much political tension, obviously, between the two countries. They must have been so worried that they might make some misstep that would cause an international incident.
Well, back to Ormandy in the Fifth versus the Sixth. Ormandy was not one to, like, just go along to go along. So he did recognize the importance of it, and he didn't want to cause a scene. So he actually, decided to play Beethoven 6 as a way of kind of appeasing the Chinese and not causing, a diplomatic brouhaha. But the musicians themselves, they just didn't know what they were getting into. They had been counseled beforehand by by people who knew China on what to expect, but they really didn't know. And in talking to them, you know, afterwards, they really had a very shallow understanding of what was happening in China during the Cultural Revolution. And during the tour, many of them said that they spoke to their counterparts who told them stories, but the Chinese musicians didn't tell them the total story of what had happened to them during the Cultural Revolution because they were still worried. You know, many of them were sent to communes to work as farmers, hadn't practiced in like 7 years as an orchestra. You know, some of them faced worse fates than that, but this was not something that they were going to bring up in conversation with the Americans, again, because they didn't know if things could change overnight. As it was, the orchestra was there in September, and by January, there was another crackdown on Western classical music from the top. You know, all of a sudden, Beethoven, who was welcomed with open arms, was then considered bad. So it was like the political winds shifted. And so a mere 3 months after their visit, there was another political crackdown on bourgeois Western music.
Yet their tour was an incredible success and did have a lasting impact. While things kind of meandered this way and that way, in the end, it did have a very positive impact.
Very positive, because, you know, the orchestra performed to select audiences. You know, there were only six concerts, but it was national news. It was headline news. And it was a way of kind of, you know, renewing relations on a more personal level. You know, after 1949, America was considered the enemy, you know, and after the Korean War, we were considered the American wolves. So if you're born, you know, after 1949, you kind of grow up with this image of Americans, you know, being the devil. And so cultural diplomacy was a way of kind of scaling back from that and changing people's perceptions. So, I mean, that's why the orchestra visit was so successful. And then, you know, but this goodwill towards the Philadelphia Orchestra just carried on into the future. And it's really the reason I wanted to make the movie and ultimately write the book is that, you know, the Enquirer sent me to China in 2008. The orchestra was going to perform an anniversary concert to mark the 35th anniversary of this 1973 tour. The Chinese are very big on anniversaries. And so the two classical music critics couldn't make the trip. And so they asked me, would you like to go to China? I'm like, yeah, sure. Because I knew my way around.
I love the backstory of that, by the way.
But, you know, I'm the first to admit I wasn't an expert on classical music. You know, I like my Tchaikovsky, but I really didn't know much about classical music. So I did what any reporter would do, and I just reported it out. And so I went like a week early and I, you know, found a Chinese composer who had performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He was a pianist. His name was Yin Chenzong. And I went to his home in southern China and talked to him about what it was like to perform with Ormandy. And this piece of music that you created, the Yellow River Concerto, was something they played. And then I went to music schools and I talked to Chinese parents who were, you know, having their children learn the violin and the piano because they wanted them to be music stars. So I was really struck, though, when I went to the actual concert and I would talk to people coming and going from the concert, just the degree of nostalgia that people had towards this orchestra. And it wasn't just classical music, it was this orchestra. They remember. They remembered 73. They remember the goodwill. So, you know, it's really remarkable. And I felt like if I felt surprised by this, you know, certainly people back home would also feel surprised. And so that was one of the reasons, I wanted to make the movie. I felt it was a chapter in our city's history, as well as a chapter in U.S.-China relations that was fading. That a lot of people know the phrase ping-pong diplomacy, but not a lot of people understand the concept of music diplomacy, which arguably has been more lasting. The orchestra has been back to China 11 times, which is more than any other American orchestra. So it's really something that, you know, this is going to sound, you know, provincial, but it's really something that is special about Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Orchestra. So I wanted to tell that story.
Yeah, and I don't think it's provincial. I think it's such an important and universal theme that resonates with so many of us, especially now as, you know, China and U.S. relations continue to intensify and the tensions continue to grow. Mm-hmm. I mean, does the history of what you know and what the Philadelphia Orchestra was able to accomplish in 1973 give you some hope in regards to future diplomatic relations?
Well, the thing about our relationship with China is we have a political and a strategic relationship, and that is strained at the moment. But what has changed so much in the last 5 decades since the Nixon trip are the other types of relationships that have been built. I mean, think about it, like education, arts, culture. You know, it's not just business. It's on a real personal level. You know, the orchestra goes to China on a regular basis, but so does every other major orchestra in the world. In addition to that, you have universities like New York University has a campus in Shanghai. The Juilliard School just opened a campus in Tianjin. So there are relationships that link us that go, you know, beyond politics and you know, security. And these are not changing. I think there's more hope because of those relationships. That might sound a little Pollyanna, but I actually believe it.
I believe it, too. I believe the power of music and the ability to share and find a common passion really mm-hmm. does kind of open up a space to mm-hmm. at least have a dialogue and have a relationship and have that connection. Yeah. And I do think that makes a difference.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories was that of the musicians exchanging gifts, mm-hmm. and particularly the gift that violinist Booker Rowe mm-hmm. gave. Can you talk about that?
So Booker Rowe is a violinist for the Philadelphia Orchestra. He just retired. And when we were making the film, we had a reunion luncheon where we invited some of the members of the Philadelphia Orchestra who had been to China in 73 and still played with the orchestra, meeting their counterparts. You know, Sharon and I went to this restaurant and we filmed them together. And the Chinese musicians were there first and the Americans came later. And as soon as Booker walked into this room, this Chinese violinist, this woman, got so excited. She ran up to him. She said, "Oh, you're the one. You're the one who gave me music." So in 73, Booker had, you know, he had Mendelssohn's quartet. He had the scores for that. And just as a gesture, you know, he gave them to, you know, his counterpart with the Central Philharmonic. And he just thought it was, you know, a friendly gesture. But what he didn't realize at the time was the import of that, because this woman, all of her sheet music had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. And musicians back then had to they had to compose by hand, write by hand, all of their music. I have a cousin, you know, from Shanghai who went to the Shanghai Conservatory, and she told me the same story. You know, that during the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guards came to our family home. They took away her piano. They broke her Deutsche Grammophon albums. They burned her sheet music. And my cousin, Julia, had to rewrite all of her sheet music. And this woman, her name was Cui, she had to do the same thing. So all of a sudden, Booker gave her, you know, this music. So we, the next year, we went back to China. I went to the couple's home to interview them, and she pulled off of her shelf, you know, the sheet music to show me. And then we went, we took her to the concert. She went to hear the orchestra performing Beethoven's Ninth, and she got to meet Booker. So it was just, you know, it was this surreptitious moment, but it was just like, to me, it kind of crystallizes the importance of that trip. It was the geopolitics, the goodwill, et cetera, but it was also kind of the meetings on a personal level. And the Philadelphia musicians went to a rehearsal of the Central Philharmonic behind closed doors. Again, they weren't allowed to be playing Western music, but this was a special occasion. So the musicians from the Central Philharmonic were rehearsing for Ormandy and his musicians, and they performed Beethoven's Fifth. And so there was a lot of interaction at that moment and at that rehearsal. And, you know, for the Chinese musicians, you know, it was just an incredibly meaningful and memorable moment. When we were making the movie and when I wrote the book, it was really important for me to include their voices. This wasn't just about the Americans going to China. It was about the reaction in China among the people they encountered.
And Booker Rowe was so sweet.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Didn't he apologize that the music was had a stain on it?
It was like secondhand scores, and there was a little stain. So he said, "Oh, I'm sorry about that." And she was quivering. She was so excited to get it.
I love so many characters in your book and so many stories in your book. But one of my favorite characters, because I'm biased as a television journalist, is Katie Martin.
Yeah.
She was the lone television journalist on the trip.
Yes.
Can you talk about sort of the incredible scene there when she wore a miniskirt on the street?
Well, Katie's one of my favorite people, too. And she didn't make the movie. She was finishing. Today she's a renowned biographer, and she was in the midst of finishing her biography of Angela Merkel. But Katie tells some great stories about arriving in Philadelphia. She's a newly minted graduate from George Washington. She got her master's in Sino-Soviet affairs. And so she shows up at WCAU, and this trip comes up. And all the veterans at CAU, they're all jockeying to be the lone TV reporter to go with Ormandy on this historic trip. And the station manager picked Cotty. And all of her male peers were furious. Their daggers were out for her. Like, how could you send this cub reporter who's been here months on this plum assignment? But she was absolutely the right person to send because she understood kind of the larger story, but she was the only person. And she tells two funny stories. One is she gets on the plane, and all of these musicians are telling her, listen, don't bother Ormandy. Don't go up to him. And Kati is Hungarian. She was born in Hungary. Her parents were refugees, and they ended up here. And they said, do not tell him that you're Hungarian. And whatever you do, do not speak Hungarian. And so Kati did what any good reporter did. She ignored them. And when someone got up to go to the bathroom and there was an empty seat next to Ormandy, she slid right in and she started speaking to him in Hungarian, and he loved it. In fact, we have a photo in the book that she lent us, which is Kati and Ormandy on the Great Wall, and he signed it to her, you know, to my dear friend. And so that was one of my favorite stories. But then she also talks about, you know, being a young woman in 1973, she would wear short skirts, but the first time she walked out to Tiananmen Square in a short skirt during the Cultural Revolution, when the only thing you were allowed to wear were gray pants and white shirts and, you know, Mao jackets, she said there was like this throng of people that just surrounded her. So the next day she went to the local people's department store and she bought herself a proper Mao suit and would only wear that then when she would go out on the street to interview.
You were talking about Ormandy and how people were whispering about how to act around him. I mean, he really was kind of a diva, but if not for him and his relationship with Nixon that had already been established, this trip might not have happened.
Exactly. Nixon liked Ormandy because Nixon was a classical musician. I think he played the piano, and he grew up listening to albums of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Philadelphia Orchestra was one of the most prolific recorders of music. So Nixon already had a soft spot for Ormandy, and Ormandy had a soft spot for Nixon. In fact, when Nixon was reelected, it was the Philadelphia Orchestra that performed at his inauguration, not the National Symphony. And so there, you know, Ormandy, the orchestra did get some pushback from some members who were not pleased about this and who did, you know, protest. But eventually the Philadelphia Orchestra, you know, took the train down to Washington and performed for Nixon. So Nixon appreciated that. So when the idea of sending an orchestra to China came up, it could only be the Philadelphia Orchestra. The other reason is the Chinese had a soft spot for the Philadelphia Orchestra. So in 1940, the Philadelphia Orchestra held a benefit concert for China. Now, China's in the midst of a war with Japan, and this was a fundraiser to raise money for their medical relief. And so China never forgot that. So when it came time to pick an American orchestra to come to China, they were kind of the obvious choice. It could only be them, really.
And in the book, there is verbatim of a telephone call.
Yes.
That President Nixon and Henry Kissinger and Ormandy had when Ormandy was actually invited to go to China for this tour, right?
Yes. Yeah, I remember when I found that. And Sam, you remember I called you and played it for you? And I was like, you won't believe what I found. So that was in the bowels of the Nixon Library. You know, the Nixon Library was an important source for us for the movie because all of the film that was taken during Nixon's trip to China, even the outtakes, have been digitized by the Nixon Library, and they're all available online. And the best thing is they're free because it's part of the National Archives. The other thing that the Nixon Library has made available, and this was by an act of Congress, actually, is all of the secret recordings that Nixon made on his telephone are now available through the Nixon Library. So I just did a little basic reporting. I figured out like when the orchestra announced that they were going to China, which was February of 1973. And then I just went into the archives of the Nixon Library and looked through February, and bam, there was an entry that said Ormandy. So it was like unbelievable to hear Nixon talking to Ormandy. It was a crystal clear recording, and it's right there online and free.
You make it all sound that is key. You make it all sound so easy, but I know that this was countless hours of research and hard work. What were some of the major challenges, especially in putting together and doing the additional research for the book?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with the movie was knowing what not to include. Mm-hmm. The problem with research is then you end up with a ton of research, and it's like distilling the information into the story. And finding the story. We went out with the orchestra three times, and it was only like when we're in the editing process that you realize, oh, okay, this is the story, you know? And so one of the key characters in the movie is the composer Tan Dun. And when Sharon and I and Rachel were in the editing suite, and Sam, you know, when we're watching the Tan Dun portions, it's like, this guy is magnetic, and we need to use him as the thread. So, you know, the hard part with the movie was knowing what not to use in the research. The hard part with the book was just making the oral history compelling and making sure that it made sense and flowed. But you'll be the judge of that.
It is beautiful. I mean, I've read it, and it is so captivating and really extraordinary to hear all of these voices and, again, feel like you're right there witnessing history as they tell it. It's just really wonderful. And the pictures as well. I mean, there are additional pictures and things that we don't see in the film.
Right. So the orchestra made available their archives. So a lot of them are the official photographs that we're taking during the tour by professional photographers, but also by the musicians themselves. Mm-hmm. So the orchestra has in its possession like hundreds of slides that were taken by some of the musicians who were very good photographers. The late Alan Abel, who was the percussionist for the Philadelphia Orchestra, took very good slides. And in fact, he used to take his camera on stage and secretly take photographs from stage. The doctor who traveled with the orchestra, Dr. Viner, he and his wife traveled with the orchestra. She's a nurse, he's a doctor, but he took a lot of photographs and shared those. Again, the Nixon Library, I was able to get some photos of Nixon in China from the library. But the orchestra, just has a wealth of material. And you can also find many of those same photographs at the Penn Libraries in the Kislak Center for Special Collections. They have the Ormandy Archives, and you can, if you ask nicely, you can see them.
And the film covers a long period of time, whereas the book really focuses on the 1973 tour.
Yes. So that was intentional. I just wanted to focus on 73 because 73 was really the historic moment. And I wanted to go deep on that, deeper than we did in the movie.
Is there a favorite tale that we haven't covered or a favorite character we haven't covered that you really want people to know about?
Well, when we were doing the film, we were trying to focus on the Philadelphia musicians who were still playing with the orchestra. But with the book, I was able to kind of expand the parameters. And there was one musician who I really love, Bobby DePasquale. He is one of the famous DePasquale brothers. There were three of them who were in the orchestra. And he told a wonderful story, which I tell in detail, in the book. Bobby lives in Cape May. And they were in Shanghai. He was coming downstairs, and in the lobby was Cotty Martin and Harold Schoenberg, who was the New York Times critic. And Harold says to Bobby, he goes, you want to go for a walk? So he said, okay. So they go for a walk. They're in the, if you're familiar with Shanghai, they're in the old French concession, which is a beautiful part of the city. It has lots of trees, and it's just, you know, very intimate. And they're walking down the sidewalk, and they hear a violin. And, you know, Bob stops, and he said, you know, oh, it's coming from up there. So they, there was a little boy on a porch, a balcony, playing the violin. And they motion him to come downstairs. So he comes downstairs, and this is, you know, a sidewalk in busy Shanghai. And then Bobby takes the violin, and he shows, you know, it's this little child's violin, and he shows him, you know, how to do the scales. And the kid is just like agog. And then he starts showing off. I can't remember the piece he was playing, but he played some magnificent piece. And, you know, then he had a Polaroid camera, so they took Polaroid shots. And he said, you know, this impromptu concert, like there were hundreds of people who had stopped in their tracks just to hear it. And, you know, this little boy just got this tutorial for one of the greatest violinists, you know, with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So that's one of my favorite. The other good Bobby story is that he, like many violinists, he had a bad neck. It's like a, you know, an occupational hazard. If you're like this for your entire life, you're going to have a bad neck. And he was in constant pain. So he heard about acupuncture, and Dr. Viner was also very interested in acupuncture. So when they were in China, they requested to go to a hospital and to talk to doctors about it. So Dr. Viner took Bob DePasquale and some of the other musicians with him, and they observed an operation. There was like a surgical theater, and they were, you know, above this operation where this woman was getting operated on for, you know, a mass in her stomach, and the only anesthesia was acupuncture. Mm. So Bobby said, I want to try some of that. So he got it, and he swore that it, you know, it helped him immeasurably. And he said when he came back to Philadelphia, he kept getting acupuncture for his whole career. Word spread then through the orchestra, and they actually then had a Chinese doctor come backstage, and it was like, you know, an assembly line of acupuncture. So they all gave it a try.
Converted to Eastern medicine.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
You are now working on a new project that
yes.
involves ballet. Can you tell us a little bit about that, especially because my daughter would like to know about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So my new project is looking at the stories we tell through ballet, and particularly how we portray Asians in classical ballet. So think about like the Nutcracker, the Chinese scene where a man in a conical hat pops out of a box with a Fu Manchu mustache. Think about La Bayadere and the savages in the Hindu temple. And I focus on work by two dancers in New York, Phil Chan and Georgina Paskogin. Georgina is a soloist for the New York City Ballet, and they're basically asking the ballet world, can't we do better? And they're trying to take an art form that really sprang from the imagination of Europeans in the 18th century and make it more authentic to audiences today. And they've created this movement, and the name of the movie is Yellowface. And Gina and Phil have gotten thousands of signatures. They've gotten every major ballet company in America to sign on. The Paris Opera Ballet just recently pledged not to do blackface and yellowface anymore in their ballets. It's kind of hard to believe that in this day and age they were still doing it, but they cited the advocacy of Gina and Phil. So Yellowface is my next project, and hopefully you'll see it sometime in the next decade. But
I am so glad that you are amplifying this very important effort and initiative. I cannot wait to see it, so thank you. I could talk to you forever and ask you a million questions, but we did promise audience Q&A. So if you have a question for Jennifer, please just raise your hand. There are microphones in the back, so if you have a question, we just ask that you ask it in your microphone.
Thank you for your comments and questions. Has the documentary been shown in China? If so, what was the reception, both officially and unofficially?
Sadly, the film cannot be shown in China because of censorship. The Cultural Revolution is still too sensitive, and Chairman Mao's wife, Jiang Qing, is definitely off limits. You can't show any images of her. And, you know, Sam and Sharon and I decided that we weren't going to take out that section of the movie. So, alas, it won't be shown in China, but it will be shown in Hong Kong. The Asia Society is going to screen it when they come out of their lockdown. You know, it's available in Hong Kong, but alas, not China. But that's the Chinese censorship. Are you asking about your free copy?
My free copy costs $37.
Okay, but I'm going to go to your movie. Sam has a new movie coming out on the bankruptcy of Detroit.
Yes, it bankrupts a lot of people. What do you think we missed?
In the movie?
Or the book?
Well, I would have liked... It's not that we missed it. It's just that we couldn't put it all in, and we couldn't get it. I would have liked to have included a little more on the suffering of the Chinese musicians in 1973. And again, it's not that we didn't get it. We didn't put it in because we didn't have it in to the extent that we would need. So I don't know, Sam. I think we got everything right in the movie and the book. But the book does go a lot deeper on 73 and kind of, just captures the zeitgeist of the moment and how in 73 we were just strangers trying to reconnect. So, but it's perfect otherwise.
I don't recall learning this in the film, but one of the things that kind of made me giggle as I was reading the book was the account of the musician who had lost his passport almost missed the flight to China.
Yeah, now help me out. Was it the trombone or...
It was the trombone player.
Gil
Johnson.
Trumpet? Okay,
The trumpet principal, Gil Johnson.
So they made a stop in Hawaii on their way to China. So they had to go from Philadelphia to San Francisco to Hawaii, then on to Japan, Shanghai, Beijing. That's how you would get to Beijing back then. And they're staying at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, and, you know, they would collect the passports in the morning in a sheet, you know, pillowcase. And this Gil Johnson said, oh, my God, I can't find my passport. And so no passport, no travel. And Ormandy is told this, and he said, he has to come. He said, take one of my violinists, but you cannot take my first trumpet. So the violin backfield, I guess, is a little broader than the trumpets. And so they had to do all of these gymnastics. They called ahead to Japan, and so they had a new passport waiting for them in Japan. And then they got the Chinese consulate in Japan the embassy in Japan to stamp it with a visa. So he ended up joining the orchestra, but it was a very tense moment, and the tensest person was Ormandy.
The 50th anniversary of that tour is right around the corner next year.
Yeah.
What are the plans? Do you know?
I don't know. I have checked in with my orchestra friends, and they said, you know, they're working on it. Hopefully there will be something, but who knows? Today, if you travel to China, you have to quarantine for 3 weeks. So there's no way you're going to quarantine the Philadelphia Orchestra for 3 weeks. Who knows? But, you know, in the last 2 years, the orchestra, like all of us, have been forced to do things that would have been unimaginable before. And they, you know, made several concerts available virtually, digitally. And they've done actually the same in China. So last year was the first year, and they're going to do it again this year. They're going to have a week-long teaching course available to Chinese students. And they're really hoping to attract students beyond just the two big cities of Beijing and Shanghai and really in some of the inner provinces. So it's forcing the orchestra to think kind of creatively, too.
Any other questions?
Two, actually. One, you said that you could have submitted the film to film festivals, and I'm sure COVID had some impact, but what has been the critical acceptance? Have you been able to show it at some film festivals? And second, have you shown it to, say, Curtis students, Chinese scholars at universities around America? And what kind of reception do you find from Chinese scholars to the documentary?
Yeah, so we had a virtual premiere in December of 2020. Sam had hoped to have a premiere at the Academy of Music, which would have been wonderful, but, you know, COVID dashed those plans. So we had a virtual premiere. There were 4,000 people who signed up for it, so it was widely viewed. Curtis was one of our co-sponsors, so, you know, I'm sure Curtis students saw it. The film was in 15 film festivals. The film festival phase has kind of ended once we did our national broadcast, but it was in the Philly Film Festival and others across the country. And, you know, I'm doing screenings now with universities as well as groups like the Asia Society. I have one on Wednesday with the National Committee for U.S.-China Relations, and the reception has been wonderful. And also from, you know, Chinese scholars, too. I'm recently back from a conference in Hawaii where we showed the film to Asian studies scholars, and they embrace it. They get it. And hopefully they'll show it in their universities. But it's been very well received. A lot of China hands have liked it, and, you know, it came out at an interesting time. You know, you could argue that it came out at the worst time because U.S.-China relations have just been deteriorating. But you can also argue that it's come out at the perfect time because people are kind of looking for a story that's a counter-narrative to the one we're living. And, you know, we were on a podcast with a guy named Kaiser Guo, who's a very well-known, respected China watcher. And, you know, cynical, you know, just a serious China watcher. And he loved it because he said, oh, I just needed this story so much because it is that rare good story about the United States and China.
It is very uplifting.
Yeah.
And I love how it really does drill down on how important those one-on-one relationships are.
Yeah, you know, and it was Bob DePasquale who said, you know, after this little encounter with the boy on the sidewalk, he said, that to me was what this was all about. This is why we did this.
There was another moment in the film that just has always stayed with me, and that's when one of the musicians says, I'm the son of a cleaning man. I'm not supposed to play for the Philadelphia Orchestra. And it just shows how everyone, you know, the Philadelphia Orchestra is open to everyone, and music can really be so accessible.
Yeah, that was Tony Orlando. He's a percussionist. And in the film, we make the point that, you know, China's investing considerably in music education. And we're all Philadelphians. We all know that that's not the case necessarily in Philadelphia. And it was just 10 years ago that the school district was going to eliminate all itinerant music teachers in the system. And there was such a backlash to that that the school district was forced to reinstate the budget. So Tony, you know, makes the point that, you know, he was a kid in Reading who was introduced to music, and his, you know, mother was a cleaning lady, and here he is with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And it's one of the tales we tell is about the pianist Long Long, who told us, you know, he was 10 years old when he heard the Philadelphia Orchestra performing in 1993 at the Great Hall of the People, and how that was just transformative. And so flash forward to today, and there is a public school in Northeast Philly, which, because Long Long made a grant to the school, they were able to reintroduce music to the classroom. And the principal, this wonderful woman, you know, she said how the previous principal had cut music out of the budget, and she was hell-bent on bringing it back. And she said, thank God for Long Long, you know, and helping me to bring these keyboards into the classroom. So, yeah, music education is vital because you need young people to keep the interest alive in this art form. And Yannick says in our film that the one place where young people are embracing this music is in China. So that's why the Philadelphia Orchestra is investing, you know, one of the reasons they're investing so much in a China connection. But it's not just them. It's, again, as I said before, it's every major orchestra is really trying to develop a relationship in China.
The rapport and the clear friendship between Yannick and Long Long. Mm. So fun to see in the film. I mean, the way they kind of give each other a hard time and banter around is really
That was something. A rehearsal in 2016. Long Long was performing with the orchestra. He's performed with them about 20 times. And we were filming that rehearsal, and Sam Katz gets the credit because our cinematographer was off on another side of the stage, and Sam saw Yannick and Long Long talking, and he motioned Paul to come over. He said, get this. And it's just one of those fly-on-the-wall moments that kind of makes the story more alive. And so it's Yannick giving Long Long some notes on his performance of Rachmaninoff's concerto, first concerto. And so he's telling, you know, Long Long that you might want to change it here. And there's just this kind of, it's eavesdropping on the creative process that we don't often get to do. And it's one of my favorite moments of the film.
I know from Sam that there were so many times during filming when Jennifer would see something that wasn't really planned for the film, but just understand in the moment the importance and the significance and the beauty of that, and make sure that that was then filmed and focused on, and that you got what you needed to then include it in the documentary.
The old couple that we feature in the film who had this relationship with Booker Rowe was one of those moments, because it just kind of happened at this luncheon that we were hosting, and you could tell, you know, the connection there. So,
and for those of you who don't know, Booker Rowe was African-American. And I imagine that, I mean, there weren't a lot of black people in China, right? At
this time? No, I just attended a symposium with Booker on Saturday. And he was asked about that. What was it like, you know, to be not only one of the first African-American musicians in the orchestra, to be in China, too? And he got very emotional because he said, you know, it was the first time. Now, again, remember, civil rights movement, we're just in that period. He said, it was just so remarkable to see a country where every citizen is treated the same. And he got incredibly emotional at this, you know, this panel discussion. So, yeah, Booker is wonderful. There are only two musicians from 73 who still play with the orchestra. One is David Booth, who's a marvelous violinist, and the other is Renard Edwards, who was actually the first black musician with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The book is just such a wonderful, wonderful thing. Is it possible that this is a silver lining out of the pandemic, and this would not have happened if not for the pandemic?
If I was busy traveling the country, no, it would not have happened. So thank you, Aaron, my editor, and Gary, who's here too.
Well, there you go. Do we have any more questions from the audience? Yes.
Thank you so much. I've been so fascinated with this history for some time, and I feel like just that last anecdote about Booker, the African-American musician, going to China and feeling really moved by what he saw there. Growing up also as a Chinese-American, I feel like I wasn't really, I had a hard time, I think, understanding like my relationship to China. And it was actually through learning about even how African-American freedom fighters felt very aligned with China during so many pivotal moments that made me think, like, I really should reexamine myself in this relationship. Like, it's also, I mean, even also the 1940 moment of the war against Japan and World War II, even before the national anthem of China as we know it today was cemented as that, freedom fighter Paul Robeson, you know, singer, baritone singer, football player, but above all, like a freedom fighter, he sang the anthem also in sort of a benefit concert. And it was very special in that sense. And I feel like it took that to make me feel like I understood where I come from. It took sort of a certain bridge to make myself also fit into this history. And I guess out of that, even there's a couple questions there, but I wanted to ask if we think it's ripe for a new kind of cultural renaissance of exchange between America and its people and the Chinese people, and not only through music, but also through the arts, through literature, through all kind, and obviously also through science and technology, even despite, or in fact, even more so because there is such a maybe breakdown of understanding on the sort of political level. And then especially also one more maybe piece to it is maybe if Americans are ready to be humble enough to learn from China, the way China's so open right now to Western culture and learning about music and ready to learn about all the different traditions in the world to make itself better positioned to interface with different cultures and different nations.
So I think the cultural relationship is really evolving and was incredibly robust before the pandemic, and everything now is on hold. So focusing on classical music, for instance, you know, we were very intentional in ending our film with the present. And so, you know, we end with the Shanghai Philharmonic coming to Philadelphia to perform side by side with the Philadelphia Orchestra and performing one of the works of a young Juilliard-trained musician, Peng Peng, his name is, and it was the 10th Symphony. And this was a free concert sponsored by the Philadelphia Orchestra. And Yannick says in our film that it's important for audiences here to know kind of what's happening in China and to bring it here. And so there's been a commitment. There was a commitment from even 1973 to acquaint Philadelphia audiences with Chinese music. And I'll give you an anecdote. This is in the book, not in the movie, but when the orchestra went to China, there was one piece of music that Ormandy really liked. It was kind of folk music. It was called The Reflection of the Moon on Two Fountains. And he wanted to include it in the next season. So they had been given the score, and they wanted the program notes from the Chinese. So when they came back to Philadelphia, they wrote away, you know, to their Chinese host, and they said, send us the program notes. We want to do this. Nothing. Radio silence. They sent another letter. Nothing. No response at all. It was 4 years later that they got a letter from the conductor in China. His name is Li Dulun, who said, sorry for the late reply, but the reason we couldn't send you any information is, you know, the Gang of Four, Jiangqing, has been smashed. And we are now in a period of artistic revival. Here are the program notes. I hope you can use them. So anyway, you know, what started in 73 has only been building in terms of music. And that's not going to end. And so we are seeing more, you know, Chinese composers, their works being performed here. Again, one of the people we feature in the film is Tan Dun, and the orchestra has premiered many of his pieces, including Nushu, which is the one highlighted in the film. And that's only going to continue. And, you know, you only need to look at orchestras, top-tiered orchestras across the country, and there are musicians from China in all of them. And there are even some conductors now who are from China. The New Jersey Symphony has a conductor who is, I think, trained at the Central Conservatory, and she's now in New Jersey. And there are a couple of others. So this is only going to continue. You know, what happens at the political level, you know, that's more unclear and uncertain and fraught with problems. But what's happening culturally, I don't think that's going to stop. There is still going to be, you know, this interaction, and it is broadening.
It's flourishing, yeah. Right? Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for your great questions. Thank you for being here tonight. Jennifer, congratulations, really, on this beautiful book. Thank you for bringing it into the world. Jennifer will be upstairs signing books, and so we hope you join us upstairs. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you all. Thank you, Nydia.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.